Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon. It is a cool but nice spring day in Fairfax, Virginia, and this is Military Monday. My name is John Gresham. I'm your host. And today we're going to talk about a little-known but vastly important battle of World War II. Called the Battle of the Atlantic, it actually was the decisive campaign of a war in Europe. It was fought from the very first day of the war until the very last day of the war, but was actually won and lost during three critical months in spring 1943, 70 years ago. We're going to have two rather good and qualified guests to talk to us about this today. One of them is a past guest here on Military Monday, Mr. Larry Bond, who is a best-selling author, historian, and game designer. And another individual who is his co-author, a historian of some note in his own right, a former naval officer, submariner, intelligence analyst, and the heart of, in many ways, the game design efforts that Larry and I and other people in the team do. His name is Christopher Carlson, and he will be with us as well. Let's bring them on here. And Larry, are you there?
Good afternoon, John.
Good to have you. And Chris, you on safely as well?
Yes, sir, I am.
Excellent. Excellent. I hope the introductions are reasonably accurate. And let's just jump right in. Larry, I'm going to start with you. Give us a short rundown on what was the Battle of the Atlantic? What was the basic objective by both sides, and what was the dynamic of the situation beginning in 1939?
It's hard to do that in three sentences, but basically it was our efforts to get the U.S.'s industrial might over to help Britain, to feed it, give it weapons it needed to first defend itself, and then we started shipping our stuff over, our own troops, our own material, our own supplies, and the lifeline to Britain was essential if she was going to hold out against the entire continent of Europe, basically. Germany did her level best using submarines of what was, for that time, very advanced technology to try and choke off that lifeline. We had to escort convoys, which we didn't do at first because we didn't really think convoys were going to pay off, but we ended up doing convoys, and German, what were popularly known as wolf packs, orchestrated from shore, tried to sink as many ships as they can and starve Britain out. They didn't make it.
All right. And for our guests today, if you are interested in calling in and talking to myself, Larry, or Chris, our call-in number is 347-945-7246. If you want to go ahead and ask your own questions. And to go another step further, Chris, you've actually been out on the Atlantic, both on the surface and underneath it in submarines. Talk a little bit about the battle space. How big was it, and what kind of conditions do you find on any sort of an average day in the North Atlantic?
On the average day in the North Atlantic, it's rough. You're talking fairly decent waves, decent swells. It's often cool, and if you're off the northern side of the United Kingdom, it's often wet.
That's a normal day. Now, what is a bad day in the North Atlantic like?
Well, the bad day in the North Atlantic is when you look up to see the water coming down on you.
Okay. And these kinds of weather and sea conditions weren't just bad for the Allies trying to ship things across. They were bad for the U-boat men as well. I mean, it was a equal opportunity enemy of all sides, correct?
Absolutely. Particularly in an era where you didn't have the best radars, and initially the Germans didn't have radar at all on their submarines, so you were to visual detection or acoustic, and big waves, lots of noise, poor visibility. It made it very hard to find your quarry.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that the U-boats, although they were submarines operated a lot of the time on the surface. And if you think of them not as submarines, but as very, very small surface craft, you can imagine, you know, sea conditions that would, you know, a destroyer or a merchant ship could deal with were hell on earth for a surface submarine. So their seamanship was just as necessary as anything else.
Larry, let's talk about the matchup as it was during the first half of World War II in the North Atlantic. And I'm going to let you talk about Great Britain. What did Great Britain bring to the fight in the North Atlantic when hostilities broke out in 1939?
Well, obviously her primary function was as an unsinkable base. I mean, because of that very wide, very rough moat called the English Channel, the Germans could not get across to England, and although they tried with Operation Sea Lion, they ended up abandoning it because the German Navy and the German Air Force really weren't up to that task. Britain was the center for Allied reinforcements into Europe. That we knew we couldn't invade right away. The first thing we had to do was simply keep Europe alive. I think Chris probably has the number for how many shiploads had to be provided in terms of food and fuel and other things, simply to keep Britain fed and warm. Beyond that, to fight, she needed more fuel, more weapons from the U.S. because her own factories were being blitzed. And then we started sending our reinforcements over to begin the buildup, which ultimately led to D-Day. It was a tremendous logistical effort. It would have been bad enough, hard enough, even without German opposition, simply to ship all that stuff over there. The Atlantic is a very unforgiving place to try and sail.
Chris, let me ask you, you know, Larry just pointed out there are raw statistics and numbers that really drove the Atlantic battle. Lay some of those out at both during the beginning, the mid-war period, and you know what, and again during the build-up to D-Day. Lay that down and lay out the challenge for the German U-boat arm of what did they have to do to win this fight.
Since this was probably the purest form of war of attrition, both sides, the Germans and the Brits, came down to the same metric: the number of gross registered tons that they had to get across or that they had to sink. For the Germans, they estimated they needed to sink 700,000 gross registered tons per month to strangle Great Britain. The Brits were slightly more pessimistic. They thought it would take 600,000 tons of gross registered tonnage of ships to be sunk per month, and that they would not be able to feed their people, arm their military, or even keep the lights on, if you will.
So there's this constant battle of production trying to keep up with the number of ships sunk and keeping them manned and getting across, obviously.
What was one number that might help people, the listeners, put this in perspective is, what's an average Liberty ship or a cargo ship at that time, how many gross registered tons does that represent?
Well, you're talking on the order of about 6,000 to 10,000 tons, depending upon the type of ship you are. And to help people out, gross registered tonnage is merely a measurement of volume, how much water the ship displays. It doesn't get into its carrying capacity or anything like that.
So in other words, roughly speaking, the Germans had to sink about 100 ships a month to go ahead and get into the ballpark where they might be strangling Great Britain.
Depending upon the size, you're talking between 100 and 130 ships a month.
And Chris, how big a force was there that the Germans had to work with?
Well, initially, since Adolf Hitler took them to war far earlier than imagined, the German Z-Plan was not even remotely fulfilled. They had very few surface ships. Not even their second battleship had been commissioned, and they had nowhere near the number of U-boats they planned on having. They had a few dozen, and most of them were not ocean-going. So Dönitz had very limited resources initially, but that didn't stop him. he took to the aggressive and put ships out there to attack merchant traffic coming to England.
And, of course, then in early 1940, they drew an inside straight, and they got France and the Atlantic bases down on the coast of France, which changed the dynamic significantly, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Instead of having to waste a lot of fuel just to get around Britain through that bottleneck in the Baltic, they now had open water, and they were much closer. So that gave them not only access, but greater time on station.
Now, there's a third player here that, for a period of time, remains not entirely engaged, but does after Pearl Harbor come in, and that's the United States. Larry, give us a little perspective on the point of view of the United States going into the mid-war period and what they were contributing by this time to the fight against the U-boats.
Well, the immediate response, and this actually started before Pearl Harbor, was the Lend-Lease program, where we were basically providing war material to Britain because our production facilities were not being bombed constantly. A lot of U.S. equipment went over to the Brits, and was 50 U.S. destroyers were lend-leased in return for bases on a 99-year lease. And actually, the lease expired not all that long ago, actually. But the production capacity of the U.S. was the main thing at first, and our whole foreign policy was simply keep Britain alive by whatever means was necessary. Once Pearl Harbor started, we were now an ally, a military ally of Britain. Some of the subterfuges that we had to use to get supplies over to England could go away. For instance, it used to be that airplanes were built in a factory based right near the Canadian border, and then teams of animals would pull them across into Canadian territory, where they could then be ferried to England. The idea was that nobody had directly moved the airplane over. It had been done by animals, so therefore we managed to satisfy a legal requirement.
No Teamsters were used in the transportation of these aircraft, and consequently, of course, the Constitution and the War Powers Act were essentially held intact. Chris, the Battle of the Atlantic was also a battle of personalities, and I'd like to go ahead and have you lay out the three dominant personalities, and we'll start with Germany's head of the U-boat arm, and that being Karl Dönitz. Talk a little about him and what kind of a man he was and what kind of a philosophy he had in going in and leading the Germans in this battle.
Dönitz was a professional naval officer. He served in World War I and commanded a U-boat in the Mediterranean during that war. He had the unfortunate of being captured, but he used his time in captivity to come up with his wolf pack or Rudel Taktik ideas, where a group of submarines would attack a formation of merchant ships to overcome their defenses. He would later on work on that and would actually work with his staff, work with commanding officers as war came up. And he came to the conclusion that he, from shore, with proper information, accurately given, quickly given by his commanding officers on the scene, he could lead the fight from headquarters on shore. He was convinced he could do that because he now had access to all the information. But he drew the line at executing the attack. He would get his guys in position, and then he would back off. At that point, he was convinced it was up to the local commander to execute the attack because he had instant access to the information on board his submarine, whereas Dönitz would have to wait. And quite frankly, during the attack, the U-boat couldn't necessarily communicate. This whole thing was predicated on communications, which was both a blessing initially and then a fantastic curse for the U-boat force.
Okay, and Larry, let's talk then about the man who was trying to defeat Dönitz and his U-boats. Himself, ironically, a submariner and Victoria's Cross winner from World War II, Admiral Sir Max Horton. Talk a little bit about that man.
Oh, you're. I'm sorry, I've got to flub that test. I'm much more familiar with Ernest King or some of
well,
the
let's
U.S.
go ahead
commanders,
and,
but I don't know Horton that well. Chris,
okay,
can you talk about Max?
Yeah, he also was a World War I submariner. He had he commanded E-9. And he became the second commander-in-chief of the Western Approaches, which is a fancy title for he had all of the routes bringing the convoys into the UK. And since he knew the enemy well, being one himself, he started organizing his ASW forces as best he could with what he had to combat his understanding of the threat. One of the things that we'll see later on is he formulated a plan that once he had sufficient resources, and it took a while. In fact, it took up to 1943, May timeframe, before he started executing. He was the guy that formulated the idea of the hunter-killer groups. Before then, you had support groups. You had groups of escorts that would help on a temporary basis, a convoy. Max Horton came up with the idea of going on the offensive, building a group of ships, often around a small carrier, to go out and hunt U-boats before they even got near a convoy.
And, Larry, you and Chris, describe this towering man, at least in U.S. Navy history, who was Admiral Ernest J. King.
There are a couple of really good biographies of King out there. I wish I could – I think the best one is probably Master of Sea Power, but King came into he had, like Horton, served in submarines. He had also gotten his aviator's wings and served in the surface navy. So he knew every aspect of U.S. fleet operations. But he was appointed to be commander-in-chief U.S. Navy in February of 1941 as promoted full admiral. And he was an absolutely amazing personality. It would have been fascinating to be around him as long as you weren't the target of his interest at the moment. He appears to have been amazingly intelligent, focused, but also a genuine son of a gun. He didn't like to talk to the press. So the joke goes that he wanted to issue one press release at the end of the war that said, "We won." But he did not obviously tolerate any incompetence or careerism around him. He also drank like a fish, but managed to master it, thank goodness, and did more to lead the Navy in the proper direction than any other two or three admirals I could think of.
Chris, he also had some downfalls in terms of fighting the Battle of the Atlantic. Lay those out for us.
Well, the initial problem was that King's heart and soul, if you will, was in the Pacific. He viewed that as the theater that the U.S. should be spending more of its assets on, and really didn't agree with the Germany First concept. He was also somewhat anti-British. He had a bit of an attitude that British had made too many mistakes early on, and that they, the United States Navy, could work this themselves because they had the luxury of making their own mistakes. That proved to be a little hubris, and it came back to bite us. But as Larry pointed out, King was a very smart man, and when he realized it wasn't working, he turned around and he executed both organizational changes by forming 10th Fleet. He yanked back from a cruiser command, Captain Lowe, who he then had promoted to Rear Admiral, and said, fix the ASW problem. And once he realized what the issue was, King turned to and really worked the problem, worked it hard.
Now, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it, what was 10th Fleet? What was its purpose, and how big was it, and how many ships did it have?
Well, 10th Fleet was a little unique. It was about 50, maybe 100 people, didn't own a single ship. Its whole purpose was to organize, orchestrate, and combat the U-boat warfare by providing information, assets, like aircraft coverage, to the convoys and to the hunter-killer groups. It was largely an information handling organization to make sure that the hunter-killer groups and the convoys had the best intelligence they could get on the German U-boats' positions and overall threat at that time.
So, Larry, we would today call it a data fusion organization, correct?
Absolutely. A lot of the war for the Atlantic was actually fought in places like the headquarters of 10th Fleet, in the Operations Evaluation Group, which was a bunch of scientists that were pulled together. Now, these days, well, yeah, let's get some smart guys and have them think about the problem. Seems like a relatively, you know, that's your first step. This was radical that, you know, scientists, Poindexters, these guys that were kind of looked down on by the average naval officer would have anything useful to contribute. But they went off and, you know, figured out the best ASW tactics based on the submarine's behavior. They found ways of, you know, organizing convoys that allowed them to operate more efficiently. Because, you know, this has been mentioned several times during the show, but the Battle of the Atlantic was a war of attrition, and it was measured in percentage points and tons, and anything you could do to get your numbers up and get his numbers down was saving lives and helping win the war.
And let's talk a little bit more about intelligence real quick, because while intelligence never sank a ship or shot down an airplane, it helped you put ships and aircraft in the places where they could shoot down other people's ships and aircraft. Chris, talk a little bit about the British intelligence and command and control at this time, particularly at a small country estate known as Bletchley Park in England.
Yeah, small country estate. Well, this is all about breaking the Enigma code, which was then codenamed Ultra, and it was the ability of the Brits to get a good glimpse, into what the Germans were practicing, what they were trying to do, not only in deploying U-boats or organizing wolf packs, but also getting an idea of what their plans were, what their technological goals were in terms of new weapons and whatnot. And it all revolved around them getting a hold of the ability to decode the German naval codes. Now, on the flip side, the Germans were doing the same thing to the Brits. And in the 1943 time frame, they were both reading each other's mail. The Germans were reading the convoy codes. So I wouldn't say that they offset each other, but, you know, you had this tit-for-tat thing going around where you would decode one message and change something. He would read it and change another thing. So you had this little vicious circle going around. But what we were doing with this information is steering convoys away from wolf packs, if at all possible, and vectoring assets, aircraft, hunter-killer groups, towards where the location were of those U-boats. And this was also helped by direction finding, which is tracking down and getting bearings on the transmissions, which was just both from land-based. And in 1943, they actually had a good amount of escort ships that could do the high-frequency direction finding, which basically told you a U-boat was within 25 miles of you.
Now, these intelligence organizations in all three nations constituted some of the greatest collections of talent in areas like mathematics, operations research, queuing theory, even musicians and chess players that were assembled outside of the atomic bomb program, right?
Oh, you had a lot of the things you talk about were a lot of the operations research techniques were built from this exercise, if you will, of combating each other. Larry already mentioned the Operations Evaluation Group. They had some extremely bright people going through and doing some very difficult mathematics to try and figure out what was the best way to form a convoy, what was the biggest size you could go, what was the best route you could take? What was the probability that the convoy would be detected? What were your probabilities of detecting, engaging, and killing a submarine? These people went to extensive measures to try and quantify these things. And then you had people like, as you mentioned, chess players, who would then take these rules of movement and play chess against the German U-boats.
Essentially, wargaming.
Essentially.
Yeah. Okay. And for our guests, if you'd like to talk to them, our call-in number is 347-945-7246 if you have a question for me or either of them. And let's continue on, and let's start with the situation because, Larry, in early 1943, things were coming to a head on both sides. Dönitz was finally getting the size of the force of U-boats and other supporting pieces that he finally needed to maybe make a run at that 600,000 to 700,000 tons a month goal. And at the same time, the Allies were desperately trying to build up their forces, their technology, their intelligence, and even build up the tactical prowess among the leaders out on the ocean. Talk a little bit about the situation as we roll into spring 1943.
Well, it was, as you said, part of the thing was simply that plans that had been put into place at the beginning of the war, or as a result of things that happened early in the war, were starting to see fruition. The Liberty ships were starting to get built. The escorts were getting the training and new equipment. At the same time, Dönitz was getting the boats were coming out of the German shipyards in tremendous numbers. U-boats. Germany started the war with a Type II U-boat, which was almost a coastal craft. It really had no place on the big pond.
They called them dugout canoes at one point.
Yeah, and by 43, we're talking Type IX, which were much more like our fleet boats had a good range and torpedo loadout, and also both sides at that point had experienced people who had been doing this for a while and had started to get good at it. So Dönitz finally gets a chance to do things he wants to do. He gets his wolf packs organized. He gets his command and control system figured out, and he starts hitting the convoys. And there were some massive battles. There's a battle called HX-229. Which actually the entire convoy battle is a single book, and it's a fascinating book and a detailed look at how these things were being fought. You can also rent the movie The Cruel Sea, which in my mind is one of the best depictions of the U-boat warfare, if anybody's looking for a Netflix recommendation.
Chris, talk a little bit about those March convoy battles, particularly HX-229 and SC-122. These were the biggest convoy battles of the war, and certainly the bloodiest in terms of total casualties across the board.
It was. HX-229 was an outgoing from Halifax fast convoy. When they talk fast, you're talking 9 to 10 knots. The slow convoy was the SC-122, and that's a 7-knot convoy. Both were fairly large, 40 and 50 ships, respectively, and only about 6 or 7 escort ships initially. And Dönitz threw about 40 to 45 U-boats against these guys in 4 different wolf packs. And it was a long, very bitter struggle that resulted in the two convoys losing about 22 ships. And they were just, it was more of a morale hit when you think about it, because the whole month of March, by the time you were done, wasn't the biggest loss in terms of tonnage that the Royal Navy or the Brits had experienced, but it was a close second. And they were really beginning to doubt whether they could pull it through. The tenacity of the German U-boats just went through and ripped these two convoys badly.
And the total losses from both the U-boats and other causes was like 120 ships in a single month, maybe 105 or so just to the U-boats. The others lost to bombers, mines, and other things. And the Germans lost only 15 U-boats. This is the point where they may actually be close to severing the Atlantic Lifeline, correct?
Well, it's kind of ironic. They were close to what they thought they needed to get. Unfortunately, by this time, the United States shipyards had, you know, they had drunk lots of caffeine, and they were cranking out so many merchant hulls that the actual amount that Germany would have to start sinking almost doubled. So in order to strangle the UK in this time frame, they would have to sink 1.3 million gross registered tons. And they had only met their 700,000 goal once in the entire war, and that was in November of 42. So while they thought they were doing better, they didn't realize the goalpost had been moved on them.
Larry, we talk about the battle of production being important here. Talk a little bit about what kind of speed the Americans were producing new merchant ships, Liberty ships, the Victory Oilers, and other things, as well as escorts. What's happening in the shipyards of the East Coast of America being run by unconventional shipbuilders like Henry Kaiser and such?
Unconventional is a good word for it. I mean, basically, he turned what had been a craft into an industry and simply said, you know, this laying the keel and doing it this way just takes too long. We can crank out Liberty ships, this Liberty design, which was a simplified breakbulk merchant ship. It wasn't anything spectacular. 15,000 tons, gross registered tonnage, so it was fairly big and modern for, you know, the business at hand. But it was built in pieces and then glued together and sent down the ways, and average building time, I was just looking that up because I was curious myself, and it was in months, whereas a normal merchant ship could be a year or more. They were literally hundreds of these ships were built in the period of a month. And so
I recall that Kaiser, in one of his more spectacular publicity moments, actually managed to build one in a day one time.
That was a publicity moment. But the point was that we could build them faster than the Germans could sink them, which is a heck of a way to look at it when these guys are getting, you know, killed and drowned and torpedoed at sea. But for the Germans, again, looking at the numbers, they could say there's no future in this because we can't sink them fast enough. The Liberty ships also were militarized and used as cargo ships and other auxiliaries by the Navy. So it was an amazingly valuable design. The Victories were simply a more advanced Liberty ship. And a lot of them served through, what, the 60s, the 70s? There might still be some of them out there operating, for all I know. It was all about the industrial production of the U.S. being brought to bear on a specific problem, and luckily a very brilliant way by Kaiser.
Chris, in addition to this, all of a sudden we're starting to produce large numbers of escorts. And these are not just escorts in the sense that they're out there. These are very well-equipped escorts. These have new technology, new sensors, new weapons, and very well-trained crews who are going and taking the inputs from those operations research groups that you were talking about and turning them into real tactical advantages, correct?
Most certainly with the Royal Navy. They were way ahead of us in the learning curve. Well, they've been doing it for a few years before we got involved. But you saw this very focused design on some compact, heavily armed ships whose main focus was killing submarines. And you saw them having the most advanced radars and sonar, high-frequency direction finding, and incredibly large armaments, usually in a head-thrown weapon, such as Hedgehog, and later on the British would field the Squid, which was really a depth-charge mortar, later in 43. And you were talking huge huge carryouts of depth charges. You're talking sometimes in the order 80, 90, and you have 6 to 8 throwers, which are guns that will throw depth charges off to the side in huge racks. You saw depth charge patterns go from like 7 charges to 24, and later on 36. So yes, you saw a lot of changes, but the Brits really led the way.
Larry, in addition, there's the final emergence of one of the things that really submariners hate, and that is they hate airplanes because aircraft sink submarines a whole lot in World War II. And in April and May of 43, we see two developments. One, the closing of the so-called Black Gap by long-range land-based bombers, including B-24s and PB-4Ys flying from places like Greenland, Bermuda, and other places. And also, for the first time, we see the introduction of hunter killer groups, where at the very center of them is this thing called a baby flat top, a escort carrier, which has a small air wing of fighters and bombers, which can go ahead and hunt submarines. Talk a little about that development.
Well, the escort carriers were another U.S. invention where we knew we needed aircraft to kill subs. Yes, the best way to kill a sub is with an aircraft. I mean, killing a sub with a ship is slow, and an airplane simply moves faster, and equipped with radar or even simply using his eyes, a pilot can see a sub and attack with anti-submarine warfare bombs. And beyond that, if a submarine knows there's a plane in the area, he can't surface and make a high-speed end around on a convoy, which was one of their common tactics. I don't think the Liberty ships were used for merchant ships. I believe it was another design. But I'm sorry, not for merchant ships, for these escort carriers. But basically,
they were mostly converted oiler design, as I recall.
Yeah, they were a little bit larger than the Liberties, but not that much. I mean, if you get a model of a escort carrier and put it down next to a regular merchant ship, or better yet, next to a regular warship, and go, this is a little guy. And they also, I mean, there are pictures of escort carriers in Atlantic storms where that deck is not level. And anybody that's inside is hanging on for dear life. They were little guys, but they provided more than fighter protection because there were not a lot of hostile enemy aircraft over the Atlantic. But torpedo bombers and dive bombers carrying anti-submarine weapons that could patrol and attack immediately, almost sometimes before the Germans even knew they were there. The patrol planes were even better because they were equipped with radar, which could see regardless of day or night and could spot a trailing submarine or a submarine making an approach. They knew, the Allies knew the best places for submarines to be if they wanted to attack a convoy. So that's where they put the patrol planes. Is there anybody over there? Oh, okay, let's go check the other spot. And so it made the Germans that much harder, Germans' job that much harder. And so their numbers went down again, even more. A U-boat that doesn't sink any ships because it can't get at them is as much a win as a sunken U-boat.
Chris, there are a lot of little technological additions at this time in April and May coming into general service that sort of all add up together and produce a result that's vastly greater than the sum of its parts. Let's talk a little bit about them real quickly. Short wavelength radar on the U.S. side, something called Sugar George, and on the British side called Centimetric. What's the value of this over earlier radar sets?
Well, most of the value came to the aircraft. In fact, most of the technological changes favored the improved ability for aircraft to attack submarines. The Centimetric, or 10-centimeter radar, which is its wavelength, one, the Germans couldn't see it. They didn't know it was there, so their radar detectors couldn't see it, the METOCs, as they were called. didn't detect it. They didn't have a counter to it till much later in 43. You also had greater range. And another nice thing out of it, with the shorter wavelength, you could see a U-boat against the sea clutter a lot better, which boosted the detection range, if you will, by about 50 to 60%. Well, that's a big deal. If you can pick up a German U-boat at 30 to 40 miles, he has no way of seeing you then. And in poor visibility, you know, he's out of luck.
In addition to radar, there's cueing from something called HFDF as well, correct?
Right. The HFDF capability existed on ships by this time. It was kind of, the first one was a bit klutzy, but it worked.
And HFDF stands for high-frequency direction finding. Essentially, anytime a submarine broadcasts a message, we can zero in on what direction it comes from and go down that direction and begin searching for a U-boat, correct?
Right. And due to the propagation path that this transmission takes near its where it's sent, some merchants have, but your escorts could know, have a bearing and know within 25 miles of that bearing along that line, there's a U-boat. And so they could vector out an aircraft quite quickly to see it and then engage it. Some of the bigger changes that also came around is we introduced something called MAD, Magnetic Anomaly Detector. So you now, for the first time, could detect a fully submerged U-boat. Didn't have great range, but if a U-boat dived on you, now you had something you could use against it.
And it literally would detect the magnetic signature of the big iron U-boat underneath the water.
Technically, it detects the disturbance in Earth's magnetic field by that great big steel structure.
Mm-hmm. And on top of which, right out of Tom Swift and his magical flying machine, there's another development for the first time in the Allied arsenal, an acoustic anti-submarine warfare homing torpedo nicknamed Fido. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, the Mark 24 mine, as it was called to hide its true intentions, was a small, for the time, passive homing torpedo that was first fielded in March 1943, but got its first kills in May 1943, and it was carried by B-24s and PBYs, PBY-5s, and basically what they would do is they would spot a submarine, and as it dove, it would come over and drop the torpedo in the swirling water where the submarine went down. It would then dive down, start doing a circle search, listening for the U-boat, and when it detected it, it ran after it. In comparison to today's world, it wasn't all that accurate, but it was much, much better than the depth charge pattern and could be delivered immediately.
And for the day, they got a couple of early and undoubtedly for the crews, very exciting kills with this magic bullet.
Yeah, the first two kills, one was by a U.S. Navy BP squadron, the other was by a Coastal Command B-24, I believe. Both happened in the middle of May 1943.
Now, Larry, in addition, all of this technology, all of this comes together into what we call hunter-killer groups. And out there at the time are two amazing men leading British hunter-killer groups, Donald McIntyre and another officer named Wake Walker. Talk about them and just how aggressive were they in pursuing U-boats?
Well, we were still being taught the same tactics when I went to ASW school in the 1970s. Walker was not terribly popular within the Royal Navy. Of course, he was an innovator and thought he knew better than the admirals the best way to hunt subs. And luckily, he was finally given an escort group of his own to go off and practice it with and proceeded to start killing U-boats. The big trick to killing a U-boat, if there is such a thing, is to recognize that just because you can't find him right this second, he's not there. What you need more than, instead of describing it as aggressiveness, which is simply attacking somebody you can see, it's the tenacity to continue to hunt for somebody you know is there, but you can't see right now. The nearest analog I can think of is Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive, who simply will not stop looking for the guy. Yeah, he's probably dead, but you know what? We're going to find the body, okay? And he just will not give up. That's what made Walker who he was. And there's a submarine down there. We're going to find it. We're going to keep looking for it. And, yeah, his crews got tired, but you know what? That submarine's in a lot worse place because it's not getting air. Its battery is going down, and you got to put yourself in their place. The last thing you want to do is let up. I'm sorry. I'm channeling my old ASW instructor here, but that's what you got to do.
Chris, there was also another very fine escort group commander, Donald McIntyre. Talk a little bit about him.
Donald McIntyre was very much like Frederick Johnny Walker. They were extremely aggressive. And although Walker was the most successful Allied commander, period, McIntyre executed a lot of the same concepts. The big thing that he promoted was tenacity. He would not give up. He would also work on different modes of attack, like having one ship try to hold contact while another does its run, because one of the problems with depth charge attacks is, well, after you drop your depth charges, you don't know where that U-boat went. You lost contact with him. So I guess the big thing you can say of both men, tenacious, absolutely tenacious, do not give up, and they understood their quarry very well, and they knew the best way to defeat them, if you can't kill them, to keep them down in a way.
That's true. The hold-on tactics are a common ASW procedure where you're simply forcing him because you're searching for him actively nearby. He can't motor away from you at high speed. He certainly can't surface and get air. And while you are keeping him from moving from the spot where he is at more than a few knots, and certainly he can't go in a straight line for very long or he'll be found. The convoy is heading in the general direction of away. When the convoy leaves, the submarine is now rendered harmless.
Okay. 1943, it's May, and all of these factors combine to create something that U-boat men who survived, and that's a very small percentage of the people who were in the U-boat arm, the survivors call Black May. Larry, talk a little bit about Black May and what kind of a turnaround it was for the Allies in that month.
Well, it was Black May has to be considered the peak of the German effort and the peak of the Allied effort to fight on each side. They all the Allied technology that we're talking about was finally being brought into play, and the Germans lost a tremendous number of ships. They lost 41. Okay, backing up. In March, the Allies lost 120 ships, and the Germans lost 12 U-boats. The following month was kind of April was kind of a break. The Allies only lost half that many, 64, and the Germans still lost 15 U-boats. So that's the German losses didn't change. Come May, stuff is coming together for the Allies, and they sank 40. Let's see, what is it? How many? I'm just double checking this number. Yeah, it's 41. I just had to look at it again because it's like it's almost three times as many ships were sunk. The U-boats were sunk, and the Allies lost even fewer ships, 43. So,
in other words, it was almost a one-for-one exchange in merchant
hulls
versus
U-boats. Which is not how you
U-boat.
Win a U-boat campaign. I mean, if you're the Germans, that's not how you strangled Germany. U-boats, in terms of tonnage and cost, they're little boats. They don't, you know, they're not battleships. They're not cruisers. But you don't have that many of them. The crews are highly trained. You can't afford to lose ships on that basis and win a war.
Chris, to say this was a shock for Admiral Dönitz at his headquarters back in France is sort of a grotesque understatement. I mean, not only has he lost 41 boats, he's lost a son, I believe, in one of these boats. And what does he do on May 24th that goes and essentially win, you know, decides who's going to win this fight?
Well, after not only did they lose so many boats, virtually every attack they made was thwarted. They were just hounded, not only by these new hunter-killer groups. There were a lot more aircraft now in this area than there was in March, the very long-range variety. There was a lot more. So they couldn't stay on the surface. So these guys were having to take extreme risk to get in and get their shots. And, I mean, Larry mentioned that it was like 43 total surface ships or merchant ships were lost. But the important thing is only 14 of those were due to submarine attacks in the convoy areas. Now, if you go to the southeasterly portions near the Mediterranean, you're talking the total merchant losses on the order of 30. But the bottom line is on the convoy battles themselves, they get 14 merchant ships and they've lost 41. That's not just shock. That's immediate pull away because I can't afford to keep this battle going. I am way on the losing trend here. And Dönitz was very close to his crews, and he did not, as some authors would say, he was completely behind the suicidal attacks. He was not that way. And he pulled his guys back because they had to figure out what was going on. Something has changed drastically in 2 months. And we need to take a step back and figure this out, or we're going to lose a lot more people. So he reacted the only way he could, and that was to
which is
there.
Actually ordering the boats out of the North Atlantic.
Completely.
And this is the moment that people like ourselves, as historians, like to point to and say, the Battle of the Atlantic wasn't over. That wouldn't happen until VE Day. But this was the day it was won.
Yeah, from this point on, it was a delaying action and a very expensive one on the part of the U-boat crews.
Well, beyond this point, things only got better for the Allies. Everything that, for instance, the U-boats weren't simply being attacked near their targets, the convoys. They were being attacked as soon as they left port by patrol planes at night, equipped with radar, so that they couldn't even run on the surface at night as they were leaving port. They had to submerge, which slows them down tremendously and means that it takes them longer to get on station, which means fewer U-boats to sink subs. The Germans invented the snorkel because they couldn't dare go to the surface anymore because they'd get attacked.
And this provides the open merchant traffic routes that allow us to build up for the invasion of Europe and eventually leads to D-Day and the successful Allied victory in Europe. I mean, there's a direct connection between the two.
Absolutely.
Chris, people have described the Battle of the Atlantic as a brutal numbers game. And what were some of the costs associated on both sides with this? Like, what percentage of the U-boat personnel didn't come back from patrol, for example?
Well, when it was all said and done, 75% of the U-boat force did not come home. That was an attrition rate that has never been matched by any military unit that I know of. That was just an unbelievable casualty rate.
And of course, these were picked crews. These were the cream of the German Navy.
And Larry, at the same time, you look at the British merchant fleet sailors, the ones who sailed under the British White Ensign. 50,000 of them, as much as we lost in all of Vietnam, being killed just trying to go and take food, supplies, and equipment across the Atlantic to keep their country alive.
And those were civilians, by the way. That doesn't count the. I mean, it's a heck of a note, but the warships that were involved in this battle suffered relatively few losses because, you know, you had to be a moron to sink an escort vessel. You were after the merchants that she was protecting. So the escorts, for the most part, there were some losses, especially once the Germans fielded their own acoustic torpedo. But the escort losses were trivial compared to the losses to the merchant ships.
And with that story told, I'd like to go ahead and let you two talk a little bit about what it is you're doing right now, because I know you're both having an exciting week. You're about to go ahead and launch a new novel here in the next week. Gentlemen, the next few minutes belong to you guys.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting segue because the book we're releasing, Shattered Trident, happens to deal with another submarine campaign, but a modern one against a much more powerful Asian power by a group of small Asian powers that happen to be equipped with really good submarines. It's a modern version of the Battle of the Atlantic. Would you say, Chris?
Yes, I would.
The book is entitled what again?
Shattered Trident. It's out May 7th, and it's just interesting that China, who is fielding this very large and very flashy looking surface navy. Their submarine capabilities and their anti-submarine capabilities are still very, very poor for whatever reason. They're working to improve them, but they're still a 3 or 4 on a 10-point scale. It just so happens that the Asian littoral countries like South Korea, Japan, Vietnam have been buying these really, really excellent quality diesel boats, and they can give the Chinese a run for their money. Which they do in the first part of the book.
Okay. Who is the publisher?
Tor Books. It's Amazon. It's at all the online retailers. I shouldn't say Amazon, but that's just Amazon because there's Barnes & Noble and all the others as well. But it will be in the bookstores as well.
And how long did it take you guys to write this story?
Seemed like years. Chris, what do you think? About a year?
Research and writing took approximately 11 months.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like it was a lot longer at times.
And, Chris, I know you have to go and go to another engagement, but I'll keep Larry if you don't mind.
By all means.
And thank you for having been with us. And, Larry, let's keep going a little bit because...
Take care, Chris.
You two don't just do... books, you do games as well. Talk to us a little bit about your role as a game designer and entrepreneur out there in the world.
Well, I don't like to use the term entrepreneur because that makes me sound like I'm trying to invent a new left-handed toaster or something. But the game designer aspect, Chris has been my wingman and co-designer on both Harpoon, modern naval, Command at Sea, World War II naval, and Fear God Dreadnought, World War I naval. Together they're called the Admiralty Trilogy, and they use a common rules system. And you want to talk submarine warfare? We can talk about how submarines behaved in World War I, in World War II, and today, and help people understand why they're still very powerful units and how best to fight them. It's a lot of fun.
For the record, by the way, fighting submarines is still really hard work today, 70 years later, correct?
Oh, it is an interesting dichotomy that I was trained as an anti-submarine warfare officer, and it's not like the Navy skips on my training or anything, but I show up on my ship with my training. I had torpedo tubes, an ASROC launcher, sonar, you know, modern gear, but I am an ensign. Or Lieutenant JG, division officer level. The guy I'm fighting is a submarine captain. who's been doing this job for 20 years and knows his boat inside and out. And I'm, you know, and if it wasn't for the fact that I can see the sunlight and can move a little bit more easily than he can, I'd say that man has all the advantages on his side. A modern submarine is an amazingly dangerous opponent.
So what is it that you and Chris will be doing next? I mean, you do have more books ahead, and you are obviously continuing to evolve your Admiralty Trilogy series. Talk about those real quick.
Well, it's the last thing we're out with, which came out in March, is called Bywater's War. And it's a real fun supplement based on a book written in 1929 by a British naval analyst called Hector C. Bywater. And he wrote a book titled The Great Pacific War of 1931. So it's one of the first big techno thrillers. It was amazingly popular, sold well, and it's a great story. And it had this hypothetical war between the U.S. and Japan. He got some things right, got some things wrong. But because he was a naval analyst, he even included stats for the ships that he had created for this hypothetical future for him war. We poured all that into Bywater's War. Right now we're working on updating some of the other games, like Harpoon. We have one coming out in the Spanish Civil War titled Shattered Armada, which looks at the 1930s and what the units that were involved in the Spanish Civil War. We're also working on another book, which I can't tell you anything about yet, but Tor wanted another book, and we were happy to sign a contract and start typing again.
You've had a pretty good run as an author, historian, and game designer here. I mean, like you and myself, we both had our very profitable collaborations with Tom Clancy. But you've been one of the real survivors out there who's managed to turn this into a career and really a lifestyle in some ways. How do you like what you do for a living? I mean, it certainly wasn't what you set out to do in the first place, but obviously here you are.
Well, it's you know, I go and talk to English classes and sometimes to career classes. Well, Mr. Bond, you know, there aren't a lot of writers in this immediate area, so, you know, how did you become a writer? And I have to say, well, I started by programming computers and hating that, and then joining the Navy because I hated computers, but I loved the Navy. But then while I was in the Navy, I discovered naval analysis, and while I was doing naval analysis, I started writing war games. And the war games were bought by a guy named Tom Clancy. And when I associated with Tom, I ended up saying, gee, this writing is a lot of fun. I can do this O'John O'Marcia stuff. So it's a series of connections. And I'm lucky for each one. And I guess the only moral you can make is to, you know, never pass up an opportunity if it's at all possible for you to follow up on it, because you never know where it's going to lead.
Well, I know that you've enjoyed your career as much as I have mine, and I hope we get to have you and Chris on again sometime, because you're always a great guest.
Well, thank you, John. It's a lot of fun, and you know I hate to talk about this stuff. So
oh, yeah,
anytime
hate
at all.
It. Anyway, and with that, folks, we're going to go ahead and close out another edition of Military Monday. We're getting together, I think, another great show next week, and assuming the guests come on that we expect, we're going to be talking about 4 months during the Cold War in 1960, which started out very badly, but ended up revolutionizing the strategic intelligence business. I look forward to talking to you again. And for the RightStream Network and Blog Talk Radio, this is John Gresham saying, have a great week. Bye-bye.